Let us start. So, yesterday we started to discuss how to construct a non-abelian gauge theory, so a generalization of quantum electrodynamics based not on the U1 group as electrodynamicists, but on a non-abelian group, which is the SU2 group. So, I started to discuss a non-abelian theory based on a symmetric group SU2. Okay? So the idea is we want to have spin one particles, which will represent some generalization of the electromagnetic field, carrying interaction between charged particles, but now the charge associated to a non-abelian group. So we have, for the matter fields, for instance, a field phi, which has now two components, phi 1 and phi 2. This is for the case of the spin 0 scalar field. And in that case, those phis are complex fields. So each of the fields is a complex field. It carries some charge. But there is, in addition, some symmetry in the field. And for instance, if you consider a spinor, then it will be a two-component Dirac spinor. Dirac field. So each psi 1 and psi 2 is a Dirac field. So it has, it carries its own component with a Dirac indices. Okay? And we have seen that, in fact, we want a symmetry which is generated by SU2. So remember, SU2 is a group of unitary matrices, complex matrices, such that G times G dagger 1 and such that determinant of G equal 1. So this group is a dimension 3 group, dimension SU2 group 3, which means that it has three generators, which I take to be the TA equal 1/2 of what let me write like sigma A, where the sigma A's are the Pauli matrices. So sigma 1 is 0, 1, 1, 0. Sigma 2 is, if I'm not mistaken, 0 minus I, 0. And sigma 3 is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. Okay, and so those are Hermitian traceless matrices. Okay, and this means that a symmetry, a group transformation, a symmetry is an application which maps the field phi into phi plus I alpha A times the TA, times phi. Remember, these are infinitesimal components. Those are real numbers. Real numbers. And this is a matrix, a 2x2 matrix. And phi the field, so this, okay, and the same for the action of the group on the field phi. And we have seen that if we have this symmetry, which for the moment is a global symmetry, we have three currents. Because of the symmetry, we have three currents, conserved currents, G, A, mu. Remember, so A labels the from 1 to 3, and A labels the indices of our labels, the generator of the group, you see? And we have three currents, G mu A. I wrote why those currents are as a function of phi, for instance. And it's convenient to regroup those three currents, which are associated to the three generators, the SU2 group, into a current that I can call G mu, which is simply the sum from A equal 1 to 3 of the, each component of the currents times the generator of the group. So this is also a 2x2 matrix. Yes?
Check the J A mu, is that a vector adjoint representation of this?
No, the G A mu are just real numbers.
They're not acted on by elements of SU2? I'm wondering.
They are not?
Why they. Okay.
So there are components. So each G A mu at a given point X is a real number. Now, if you consider this as a big vector, which has four Lorentz indices and three group indices, you see, this is a vector for the Lorentz group. And if you write, if you consider GA is a component of an object which is the current G mu in a basis given by the TA, G mu, this object belongs to the adjoint representation of the group SU2 because it's a 2x2 matrix. Here again, this is a 2x2 matrix. As the sigma A, as the TA. So it belongs to the adjoint representation of SU2, and it's a vector for the Lorentz group because it carries a mu index. So we have seen that, in fact, if we want to have an interaction between this, which is the matter sector for my theory, and if I want to have a spin one H field, so the generalization of the electromagnetic field for this theory, I need to have three MUA, A, 1, 2, and 3, which will be three gauge potential. I have three gauge potentials, which of course depends on the condition of the space, which are just a generalization of the vector potential of electromagnetism. Simply, I have three gauge potentials because now I have three currents. Why in electromagnetism I have just one current, which is a charge current of the electron? Yes?
Any particular reason why it's spin one?
Why?
Spin one?
That's because, first, I want to construct a theory of spin one particles. Okay, that's the purpose of the course. Because they are there in nature. The world, the universe is made out of spin one particles, the gluons, the vector bosons for for the electroweak interaction, the photon. There are some spin, there are a lot of spin one half particles, the quarks, the leptons, the neutrinos. And there is, up to now, only one spin zero particles we know, which is the Higgs boson. For some reason that we partly understand, partly not, it seems that spin zero particles, although they are very easy to define theoretically, are very rare. So the world is made out of spin one half and spin one particle for some deep reasons. So ask the person in charge. Yes?
First, so what is the difference between the non-abelian spin zero and
what is the difference between
non-abelian and abelian spin zero scalar field?
Oh, it's just that when it's abelian, there is just one field carrying one charge. You see? Here I have two fields, and they carry, in fact, three charges. There are three different three currents. So it's not just a copy of two U1 fields, which is very simple. It's a field which has more physics in it. Because there is symmetry which mixes phi 1 and phi 2. Because you see, in the generators, those two generators mixes phi 1 and phi 2. They make rotations to the phi 1 and phi 2 plane. So they mixes the particle of type 1 and the particles of type 2. So it's more than just two copies of the U1 group of electromagnets. Okay, so we have three gauge potential, and we have seen that again, it's convenient to move them into a 2x2 matrix, which is defined exactly in the same way, sum from I to 1 to 3 of A, B, A, of X, of course, TA. Okay. And then, in order to build a theory which is consistent, like exactly is done for quantum electrodynamics, when you have only one kind of particles, you need to introduce now to make this global symmetry a local symmetry. So you need to introduce the concept of local gauge transformations. Okay. And local gauge transformations are defined exactly like the global symmetric transformation, except that here the transformation depends on locally on the field. So local gauge transformation on the field is something like I transform phi of x into phi of x plus I alpha a of x times ca times phi of x. So now it depends on a local gauge transformation parameter. And we have seen that similarly, mu of x has to be changed as mu of x plus something which would be very similar, but very similar to what is we have done for electromagnetism. So for electromagnetism, we expect that it should be something like d mu of alpha of x. But there is an additional term, which is minus I the commutator of A mu of x with alpha of x, where, as usual, alpha of x is just a 2x2 matrix, which is defined by sum from of A from 1 to 3 of alpha A of x times TA. You see? And so this is the general form from the gauge transformations on the gauge field. And if you think about it in terms of components, that's something I haven't done last time. Remember, A mu is a 2x2 matrix which depends, which has three components, which has the A mu A. If you write out what it means for the A mu A, equivalently, the gauge transformation for each of the components of the gauge field, the A mu A, is, well, this is just very simple. Here, what you have to take is the A component of the gauge transformation alpha of x, so alpha A of x. So you have to take the gradient of alpha A of x. And here, what you have to take is the commutator of the component. And so here you have to take into account what are the commutators of two generators of the field. So we have to consider what is the commutator of a TA with a TB. Okay? And you have seen in the lecture about group theory that this, in general, in full generality, defines what is the structure constant. This defines what are the structure constant of the theory of the group. And in the case of SU2, where you can compute very easily what are the commutators of the Pauli matrices, you found that this is simply I times epsilon ABC TC. Of course, there is a TC, where epsilon is completely the rank 3, completely anti-symmetric tensor. So it's a tensor so that epsilon 1, 2, 3 equal 1. And from that, you get all the other elements of the tensor by applying the fact that it's anti-symmetric. So for instance, you have that epsilon 3, 2, 1 is minus 1, for instance. Because in order to do that, you have to make 3 permutations. Okay? So then this gives for the law of transformation on the gauge field, where is it? You get, if you work this out correctly, you get plus epsilon A D C D mu B alpha C of X. Okay, so this is very important. Rules for performing a local gauge transformation on this gauge potential, my theory. So you see these terms and these terms, you know them because they are the same for electromagnetism. Simply there is no A. Okay? What is new? And there is no I. Why is there no? There is no I. So this is the ordinary term for electromagnetism, for the Maxwell field. This term is new, you see, and it comes from the fact that now we have three currents and belonging to a non-abelian gauge theory. So we have non-trivial structure constant. So this is a new term, and there is, of course, I'm sorry, I'm pretty stupid. This is an A mu B, there is no derivative. A mu b, I'm very sorry, this is a commutator. So this is epsilon ABC, A mu b, alpha C of X. And this depends on X. See? I'm sorry. So these terms involve the product of some component of the gauge potential with some components of the generator of a local gauge transformation. This term is new. New. Okay. And I introduced briefly at the end of the lecture of yesterday the important concept of covariant derivative. Covariant derivatives are a generalization of the ordinary derivative of a field where you add to the ordinary derivative a bit of the gauge potential. So the covariant derivative for the the scalar field is d mu phi equal d mu phi minus mu dot phi in global notation, which means in component notation that d mu phi equal d mu phi minus I ta, the generators. Sorry, there is an a, let me write, there is an a mu a. So this, remember, this is a component in terms of x. So phi depends on x. So this is the ordinary derivative of the field phi of x. And then we have a minus I a mu a of x times ta times phi. Well, remember, TA is just one half of the Pauli matrix.
Excuse me?
Yes?
When you said in component form and then wrote the second equation, what did you mean by component form?
Components means that I'm writing this in terms of the TAs. So now, here, A is a 2x2 matrix that I apply to this vector. Now here, but
So
first, I decompose it in terms of the component of the gauge potential. A equals 1, 2, 3, remember? And if I want to be a bit later, I can write it in terms of the component of the field. So here, I sum over A equals 1, 2, and 3. And if I want to write it in terms of the component of the matter field phi I, well, remember, here now A will go from 1, 2, to 3, and I will go from 1 to 2. I get that is this d mu of phi I of x minus I. So A mu A of x is already a fixed number. But here I consider the matrix element T A I G phi G of x. Well, this is a matrix element of T A. But remember, T A is a 2x2 matrix. So this is a matrix element I G of the 2x2 matrix TA, which is related to the Pauli matrix sigma A. Okay, so this is the global expression in a very compact form, which contains in terms of the component. Okay, so this is the rule for defining what is the covariant derivative of the field, of the field. Okay, and you have in the same way a definition of what is the covariant derivative of a field in the adjoint representation. So in particular, you know, what will be the covariant derivative of the gauge potential itself. And the covariant derivative, for instance, of an alpha A will be, if I found my my correct definition, where is my definition for covariant derivative? Yes. So this is for a field in the adjoint representation. Remember, the matter fields phi belong to the fundamental representation. And for a field like alpha A here, or A mu A itself, for which we are in the adjoint representation, the covariant derivative, for instance, of d mu of alpha is defined by as the ordinary derivative of alpha. But then I have So this is d mu alpha minus I times the commutator of a mu with alpha. You recognize something that you get here. So in terms of component, this means that d mu of alpha A is d mu of alpha component of alpha minus plus epsilon A B C A mu in terms of x A mu B of x times alpha C of X. So this is the definition of the covariant derivative acting on alpha, which belongs to the adjoint representation because it has three components. And so you recognize that with this definition, the gauge transformation is simply you change A mu becomes A mu plus the covariant derivative of the generator of the gauge transformation. So this is a compact way, very compact way, to express in terms of covariant derivative what is the gauge transformation on the gauge potential itself. Okay. So now we have all the tools, I think, to build the action. Because covariant derivatives have a very nice property. covariant derivatives are gauge invariant. So or gauge covariant, rather. That covariant under, under gauge transformations. Which means that, for instance, if phi transforms under a local gauge transformation according to these rules, which means that phi belongs to the fundamental representation, then d mu of phi, the covariant derivative, transforms also according to this rule, which was not obvious at the beginning. But it's already true at the level of quantum electrodynamics. It means that d mu of phi here transforms as exactly as phi under local gauge transformations. Okay. Good. So now, with that, we have everything. So this was our mathematics of what is a gauge transformation acting on fields. And, but now, with that, we have everything we need to build the action. The action which give you, will give the dynamics of the field. So for that, first we need to define what is the field strength. The field strength. What is called the field strength, which is, in fact, the analog of the electromagnetic tensor. In electromagnetism. You know that in electromagnetism, the gauge potentials are not physical. You can never measure a gauge potential. What you can measure are the electric and magnetic fields. And the electric and magnetic fields are contained in quantum electrodynamics, in electromagnetism, in Maxwell's theory. They are given by the component of an antisymmetric tensor, F mu mu, which is, of course, d mu a nu minus d nu a nu. Okay? And this relates. So a mu contains E and B. And this equation tells you that, for instance, E is a gradient of V plus minus dA over d, of the dA over dt, and that B is a rotational of the vector potential. Okay. So this definition is okay for Maxwell theory. But it can be generalized immediately for the SU2 gauge theory. Because you can realize that if you replace the derivative by covariant derivative, it will work as well. So let me define the field strength. The field strength F mu nu we will define as using that and using the fact that you have a covariant, the covariant derivative is defined via an anticommutator. F mu nu is defined as d mu a nu minus d nu a mu minus I times the anticommutator of a mu and a nu. So it's just a generalization of this formula where you have taken into the fact that in general, in the covariant derivative for a non-abelian gauge series, you have, in addition to this term, a term which involves the structure constant of the theorem. See? And in fact, there is a very general formula which tells that you can recognize that this is just I times the commutator between two covariant derivatives. Take this definition of the covariant derivative acting on the adjoint representation and apply it twice and take the commutator. Yes?
Sorry to ask this, but wouldn't the commutator have a factor of 2 in front of the... wouldn't the derivative commutator have a factor of 2 in front of the A commutator?
Here, no, that's by definition. This is with my choice of normalization, I get this.
Yes, but I mean on the line the line where you define F.
You mean what?
I mean, when you define F, you say you can define it in terms of the commutator of covariant derivatives, but I'm asking, wouldn't that result in a factor of 2 in front of the...
No, I don't think so. Because in any way, the covariant derivative contains an A. Here, so if I apply a d mu over an a mu here, I get the d mu a mu and the d mu a mu. So I think I'm...
No, because that's not even the...
Yes?
We're taking the covariant derivative of a adjoint representation field, right?
Of a?
An adjoint representation field?
In fact, this is I confused the word. I'm taking this acting on the fundamental organization. Because remember, I will write it in terms of component. Remember, mu is a 2x2 matrix. Okay? So this has to be considered as F mu nu is a 2x2 matrix. So F mu nu. So F mu nu belongs to the adjoint representation and it acts on the fundamental representation. But let me write it in terms of component and you will see immediately what's going on. Yes?
Don't the covariant derivatives need to act on something?
Yes, but because it's on a 2x2 matrix, it's a 2x2 matrix, it acts on that. So it means that consider any scalar field like that. What it means is that consider any scalar fields like that and apply the commutator of d mu and d nu to any scalar field. You see? I told you that d nu of phi is still a scalar, behaves like a scalar field. So you can apply a covariant derivative of that. And the miracle is that when you compute that, you find f mu nu times phi. So the derivative, the d phi, disappeared. They have disappeared because I take the commutator. So you can forget about the phi and write this as an operator, a scalar operator acting on dimensional matrix. So it's a function of phi. So now in terms of component, what does it give? Remember, it's a 2x2 matrix. So I can write as usual, f mu nu as sum from e equal 1 to 3 of f mu nu a, and this is a function of x, times ta. So the f mu nu a are the three components of f mu nu. So in the same way that you had three currents, in the same way that you have three gauge potential, you have three different electromagnetic tensors, gauge tensors. Okay, so in fact, you have three different field strength tensors. Okay, so F mu nu belongs to the adjoint representation of the group. But of course, it is still an anti-symmetric Lorentz tensor, as in electromagnetism. It transforms as the usual electromagnetic tensor under Lorentz transformation. Okay. And what is the definition of the component of F mu nu A? So F mu nu A of X are given by, you get the usual terms which are the same that in the Lorentz theory, d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, but in addition, you have a term which comes from the commutator of the a mu and a nu, and so you get plus epsilon a b c a mu b of x a mu c of x. So you see already big difference between the abelian and the non-abelian case. The field strength tensor, so the electric and the magnetic field in the non-abelian gauge theory, are non-linear functions of the gauge potential instead of being linear functions. You see, so if you want, you have three different electric fields, three different magnetic fields, and they are non-linear functions. Of the A mu A. And in addition, there is a mixing. You cannot obtain the E1 and B1 component just out of the A mu 1. You have a mixture between A mu 1, A mu 2, and A mu 3. So it's a complicated function. But this complicated dependence between the vector potential and the electromagnetic tensor is entirely fixed by the structure of the group. So it comes from the symmetry. You have no choice. You cannot change anything. If you change anything, your theory loses its gauge invariance, and it doesn't make sense. You see? OK. So now, we have everything. Because now, we can define an action S of A, which will be called the Young-Mills action, for the theory, the classical theory, and we take it to be exactly the same as what it is for electromagnetism. So I introduced here a coupling constant G. So G is a coupling constant. Remember, now I will have a nonlinear theory, so there is a coupling constant. And I take the integral over space-time of the trace of F mu nu of X. And what does it mean to take the trace? It means simply remember that F mu nu is a 2x2 matrix. So I multiplied it by itself, and I take the trace, and I get a number. And so this is a trace over the 2x2 matrix. And as usual, I raise and lower indices by using just the rule of Riemann geometry. Yes?
So is the trace in this case a trace with respect to, or a contraction of the index A?
It's a contraction over the index A. So let me write it in terms of components. I'm sorry. It's a contraction in terms of I indices. So let me write this in terms of component, because this is a very global formula. So you see immediately that it looks like the same than F mu nu, but let me write it in terms of component. Remember? First, remember that The F mu nu are expressed in terms of the TA. So in fact, I need in this formula, I need a formula which is the trace of the TA and the TB. What is the trace of a product of two generators of the group, which are 2x2 matrix? Well, you know, you can prove them out of the polymatrices, and you find that this is simply 1/2 of delta AB. So that's the normalization we took. So it's zero if A is different from B. See? So if I write it in terms of component, let me write it as a Lagrangian density. So let me write this like minus like integral of a d4x of a Lagrangian density. density for the Young-Mills fields. The Lagrangian density for the Lagrangian fields is simply, so in terms of components, it's, if you work a little bit with the trace, you get that it is minus 1 over 4 g squared times f mu nu a of x times f mu nu a of x. And here I have taken the trace. I have used this term. So this is, now this is a number. This is a real number. This is a real number. It's a Lagrangian density. And if I express it, and there is a 1/4 because there was a 1/2 here. And now if I expand it in terms of the A mu, I get a term which will be the same term than for the Maxwell equation coming from the U1 theory. So I will get a term which will be 1/4 of d mu a nu a minus d nu a mu a times the same thing. D mu simply with the indices up instead of down. And this is a d mu, I'm sorry, d mu minus d nu a mu a. This is the same term, that's the same than same as for U1 Maxwell theory. But now I have terms which come from the commutator, from the non-commutative character of the group. And I get a term which comes from the cross product of this with this. And if you write it, and if I am not mistaken, I get a minus 1/2 of epsilon A B C D mu A nu A minus D mu A mu A times A mu B times A mu C. And I get the term which comes from the product of that. And using the fact that epsilon ABC, epsilon, well, you used a formula which relates what is the product of two epsilons that I have written somewhere, which is epsilon, well, let me write it that way. Epsilon ABC, ABE times epsilon CDE is delta AC delta BD minus delta AD delta BC. So if you take a product with a summing over just one of the indices of two antisymmetric tensors, you just get a difference of two products of delta function. You get minus 1/4 A mu A mu B A mu A mu B minus A mu A mu B A mu, I'm sorry, A mu B, A mu A. Okay? So this is the explicit formula for the Lagrangian elasticity of the Young-Mills theory. And these terms are new. They come from the fact that the symmetry is non-abelian. You see? And of course, there is the G here. But you see that this is a term of order 2 in A. This is a term which involves 3 A's, and this is a term which involves 4 A. So you can view it as a free term, which is the same as Maxwell, and those are interaction terms between the A mu. So if you rescale the mu, you redefine the mu as saying that A mu is just G times some A bar mu. You see? In the action, the G squared disappear here. So if I re-express everything in terms of this rescaled field, so let me be careful, it's just a rescaling. Just a redefinition. The gauge cut in shorts. Then here I get a factor G. Let me write it because it's important. Here I get a factor G. And here I get a factor G squared. Okay. You see. So you get that the Lagrangian density of the Young-Mills theory as the ordinary term of the Maxwell theory, except that you have three different kind of photons, if you want. And you have new interaction terms between those particles. So you expect from that, from what you have learned into electromagnetism, these terms will give you three photons, because you have labeled by A. So we'll have photon propagating, but simply they carry three different numbers. Then you have an interaction which involves three photons. So you have, so this is a propagator. The propagator equals the propagator for the U1 theory. It's exactly the same thing, except that now those photons carry, you have three different photons. So those photons carry number A with A, 1, 2, or 3. But then you have an interaction term here. Which involves photons carrying A, B, and C charges. So you have three particles interaction. And it is proportional to G, the complete constant. And now you have these four terms, which involves a four-particle interaction. Which is exactly of the same form, but now you have A, B, C, D times G squared. You see? So you see that the SU2 gauge theory is an interacting theory without any matter field. So even without coupling to matter, the SU2 Young-Mills theory is a fully interacting theory. So that's a novelty compared to the Maxwell theory. In the Maxwell theory, if you have just the photon, they don't interact. They have no charge. They don't interact. Yes?
Sorry, you said you said that the photons in this case carry charge, right?
Yes.
So strictly speaking, should we mark? Should we be marking out which direction you're traveling?
Yes, but there still are there are no, they are not there are antiparticles. So if you specify the charge, you distinguish. You can distinguish between the particle and the antiparticle, and you so it's fine. You can work about that without specifying when they move. Because the charge are a bit complicated. Okay. They are still real number, remember.
Oh,
the A, mu, A are real numbers. Yeah, so in fact, no, they are non-antiparticles. They carry a charge, but they are non-antiparticles because they are described by scalar fields. Real fields, not complex fields. Okay. I think so. Yeah. Okay. So, but we will consider that in more detail because you see in particular also that the form of the coupling is very particular. You cannot play and say, okay, I will put such a coupling with some combination of the A. So the couplings are entirely fixed up to the complete constant by the gauge invariant. So the interaction terms, the coupling terms are entirely fixed by gauge invariance, okay, except for the coupling constant G. So in some sense, G is like the unit of charge of your Young midfields. It's like yes?
When you say the coupling terms are fixed or the interaction is determined by the symmetry?
Yes.
Do you mean the fact that only three can interact together or only four can interact together is fixed by the symmetry? Is that what you mean?
Yes. So that I mean that, for instance, here you have a factor 1-4. If you change by factor 1 here, the theory will not be gauge invariant anymore. Here you have a 1-4 and an epsilon EB and this particular definition. That's fixed by gauge invariance. It comes from the commutator here, which comes from gauge invariance. So all the terms are fixed by gauge invariance up to this global G factor. Okay? And so this is because the gauge bosons, if you want, the particles carry charges. And that's new. This doesn't happen in Maxwell's theory, where the photon is neutral. Okay? And finally, now we can talk about what about the coupling with matter. How does such a charge field, vector spin one field, can interact with the matter sector? Well, you have also to introduce coupling in a gauge invariant way. Yes?
So you say that the form is specified by the consequence of the local gauge invariance?
Yes.
But for example, wasn't the definition of the action a bit arbitrary? I mean, didn't we put that in by hand, the definition of the action?
No. That's the only term. The only term which involves two derivatives, which involves A. And two derivatives of A, so which contains the term of the form dA dA, has to be of this form. Because that's the only gauge invariant term you can build out of the field strength. You can, of course, take the trace of F, but this will become a series four derivative, much, much more complicated. And it will be non-renormalizable in addition. Yes?
Question about the charges. I thought you said we can think of G as a unit of charge. Is that right, or did I mishear?
Yeah, so G, in some sense, measures the strength of the interaction between the particles. You see, because this is a free term, this is... So in some sense, you can say the charge of the particle is proportional to G. But that's not Well, since it will be renormalized, that's not a very good picture. So just take it as a definition of a coupling constant. It measures the strength of the interaction.
And
okay?
The strength of the interaction depends on the tardiness. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what
okay.
I'm saying. For instance, if you take E to be the charge of the electron measures the strength of the interaction between the electron and the photon. So that's in the same sense. Okay. So now coupling with matter can be done easily. Easy. Using gauge invariance. And covariant derivative. And that's, in fact, done exactly in the same way as this was done for electromagnetism. First, let us consider Dirac fermions. So Dirac fermions field is a field which is a component of two psi, psi 1 and psi 2. So each of these is a Dirac field. So you have a two-component Dirac field. You know that the action for the action for the Dirac field is d4x psi bar I d slash minus m psi. So what you have to do is just to replace, exactly like in electromagnetism, the ordinary derivative by the covariant derivative. You take as d slash. So what is this slash? This slash is, of course, gamma mu d mu, where d mu is a covariant derivative, which is defined as acting on fields belonging to the fundamental representation as this. You see? So there is an a mu here. And therefore, in terms of component, so this is a global four, remember, this slash is a 2x2 matrix. So this is a two-component vector. You have a 2x2 matrix which contains differential operator derivative acting of psi. So this is a 2x2 component. This is a two-component vector. And you take its scalar products, which is its conjugate. So this is a number. And yes?
The Gibbs boson propagator should have two indices, A and B.
It should have?
Two indices.
Yeah, but here you see that it's the same A and the same A. So it has a delta AB.
In the Feynman rule, you have a delta AB.
Yes, so here I mean you have a delta AB because if you have a photon which carries a charge A here, it goes out with the same charge. So it's conserved. While during the interaction, you see, a photon with charge 1 can break down into two photons, one of type 2 and one of type 3. See? Because you have an epsilon AB. I will come back to this Feynman rules later. Okay. So, so this is gamma mu d mu. So obviously, this is in terms of component. Now, remember, if I write psi, the component of psi are psi I alpha. I'll write it like that. Psi I alpha, where I equal 1, 2 are indexes of the fundamental representation, and alpha equal 1, 2, 4 are just Dirac indices. And these are group indices. And then, if you write this in detail, what you get is that the Lagrangian density for this Dirac coupling plus gauge contains the ordinary term of the Dirac action. So you would get an psi bar I times alpha times I, the matrix element alpha beta of the Dirac matrix times the delta IG d mu minus I yes, minus m delta alpha beta of psi I beta. This is the ordinary Dirac propagator, Dirac term, plus a term which is looks like the same than the coupling between the electromagnetic field and mu, and it, this term will be 1/2 of psi bar I alpha gamma mu beta alpha sigma A IG psi G alpha times A mu A. So this is the Dirac term, and this is the interaction term. And so you see it involves both the gamma function and the matrix element of the Pauli matrices. So 1/2 of sigma A is the TA. So you can rewrite this interaction terms, if you want, in a form which is very similar to quantum electrodynamics. It's just 1/2 of psi bar gamma mu sigma A psi times A mu I. And this here, you have a gamma mu. So this is the term which involves the fermion and the term which involves the bosons. So you see that you get the same kind of observation. Now, the fermions carry a charge I. Remember, the index, the color indices, the gauge indices, so the SU2 index goes from 1 to 2. They may interact with the gauge potential, which carries an index A. And through those matrix elements, sigma A, I, G, they can change. So that's different from the case of electromagnetism, where either you have an electron which comes and the electron comes out. So an electron with charge minus E comes out with a charge minus E. And a positron with charge plus E which comes out with charge plus E when interacting with the gauge field. Here, a fermion of type 1, when interacting with the gauge field, can be transmuted into a fermion of type 2. It can stay the fermion of type 1, but it can stay. And this is contained in this. So in this matrix element. So you see that the interaction between the gauge field and the fermions changes the charge. And that's usual. That's normal, because the fermion, the gauge doesn't carry charge. So the interaction can switch the charge. OK? So now, this was for Dirac fermions, and for scalar bosons, that's exactly the same procedure. And I will treat the case of scalar boson because that will be important when you will study the X mechanism in the course on fundamental interactions, because the X boson, the X field is a boson. It's built out of a boson. So if you have now the bosons phi, which contains phi 1, phi 2, where these are complex spin 0 fields, okay, then we do exactly the same thing. The general action was integral d4x of 1/2 of d mu phi plus m squared, and there was a minus because I'm working in the Minkowski space, I squared plus g, well, it's a different g, so let us write it. Let us write it h over 8 phi squared. Of course, this is phi bar, this is phi bar, and this is phi bar phi squared. Well, remember, phi bar is phi bar 1, phi bar 2. And this is the most general action for scalar bosons with the SU2 symmetry. And what we have to do is to replace just this by two covariant derivatives. And again, what we get is, again, well, you can write out what it gives because you have the explicit expression for the covariant derivative acting on the gauge field, but it's easy to see that now for scalar bosons, so scalar bosons, they are charged, so they carry a charge. Okay? Two. So they are not there. Our antiparticles. So you have a propagator, which is the usual propagator which changes the charge. You have the usual interaction terms. Like that for the scalar bosons, but then this may exchange charge. You have an I and a TG, so the interaction may exchange the charge. And so these are the standard terms for the pure interaction bosons. But then in addition, you have also interactions with the gauge field. And you have two kinds of interaction because now you have two derivatives. So you may have a coupling between one gauge boson of this kind, which will look a little bit like the term of interaction for the Dirac fermion, except of course that you have no gamma matrices because it's a spin one, it's a spin zero interaction. And in addition, you have an interaction where you can have two gauge bosons carrying two different quantum numbers A and B interacting with phi and phi bar. And you can check, I think, that in this case, this is conserved, and they have to carry the same charge. But that's a peculiarity of SU. So you have interactions. Yes?
Is there any reason why in the diagram on the left, on the bottom, the four lines interaction, is there any reason why you have an I on top, J on bottom, then I on top, J on bottom, instead of I, J, J, I?
You mean here?
Farther right?
Here?
Yes, and the leftmost.
No, they can be anywhere. Simply what I mean is that if you write phi bar phi squared, this will be, you know, phi bar phi is phi bar 1 phi 1 plus phi bar 2 phi 2. So this square contains the phi bar 1 phi 1 phi bar 1 phi 1. It contains phi bar 1, phi 1, phi bar 2, phi 2, and it contains phi bar 2, phi 2, phi bar 2, phi 2. So it means that if you have a particle of type 1 going on, you must have a particle of type 1 going out. So that's why I write it in this way. But that's peculiar to the SU2. So this is for SU2.
The diagram just above the one you just discussed?
Yes.
Would you point out the term to which that corresponds?
It's just a propagator. It's a free propagator coming just from the ordinary d phi bar d phi plus m squared defined by phi term. So it will be a propagator of the form delta ij over p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon with a factor minus I, I think, for this case.
And would you mind pointing out the terms to which each of the rightmost diagrams corresponds?
This term, so let me, okay, let me just write it explicitly. Remember, that's what I wrote here. D mu phi what does it mean? D mu phi is D mu phi minus I K mu so let me write it in terms of components. So this is d mu phi I a mu a sigma a I g phi g, and I take the derivative, so this is a complex field. This doesn't change. And then I have to add this with d mu phi. And let me write it like delta ij. No, this is a rather, yes. And then I have d mu phi I minus I a mu, of course, a, no, b, sigma b, I k, phi k. Okay? And that's summing over there is. So now I expand. I get the usual d mu phi by I, d mu phi I, which gives me the propagator. And then I get a term of the form I mu a sigma I g times phi bar g d mu phi I. And remember, this is so this is complex. I get from the other terms its complex conjugate. And then I get this term, which is minus I times I, this is plus 1. I get an A mu A mu B, sigma A I G, sigma B I K, phi bar I, phi K, phi bar G, I'm sorry, phi K. So you, these terms describe these terms where I have here a photon carrying a boson carrying a quantum number I, interacting with a gauge field carrying quantum number A and a Lorentz indices mu, becoming a boson carrying number G, with here a vector system interaction given by this matrix element of a definite Pauli matrix. These terms describes similarly. I have a boson carrying a number k, getting it. I have a boson getting out carrying a number g, interacting at the same time with two gauge boson, one carrying a charge a and a Lorentz vector mu, a second one carrying a quantum number b and the same Lorentz vector mu with a matrix element given by this term. Okay, so now So, but you see, this is a product of two. You see, you have sigma A, sigma B. This is a product of two Pauli matrices. And therefore, I'm not sure, perhaps I'm wrong. So when you compute, so this is a matrix and this is an element, and then you are doing that. So you know that the product of two Pauli matrices is itself a Pauli matrix. So perhaps it's not, perhaps what I wrote here, perhaps I have it's not as simple as that. But in any way, you have an interaction between two gauge bosons interacting at the same time between. Or if you prefer, you say you have one gauge boson which interacts, which scatters on a boson and comes out another boson and another gauge boson. Okay. And I have to check because I have to write. But I think I did the calculation explicitly, and when you sum over all the indices, you use the symmetry, you get like that, but I'm not 100% sure. Okay. And one last important remark. Again, remember that it was convenient to rescale the gauge field by its Cooking constant. So if you do the same thing here, you have a factor G. Here you have a factor G squared. Okay? And most importantly, you see that it is the same coupling constant, or if you want, the same unit of charge, which appear between the interaction between the gauge bosons, and here the same. Of course, you have a G here. It is the same G which appears in the terms between the interaction between the gauge bosons and the scalar bosons, or between the gauge boson and the Dirac fermions. You see? And the coefficients here are entirely fixed by, again, by gauge invariance. So here, you have a G. Here, you have a G. And here you have a G if you are dealing with a bar, a bar, a bar. Okay? And so this means that the charges of the gauge bosons and the charges of the matter fields are not independent. All the charges, all the charges are fixed, or rather, they are normalized by gauge invariance. So you are not free to say that the charge of the gauge bosons are, let us say, 1, and the charge of the Dirac fermion is 100. They have to be the ratio between the charge of the Dirac fermions and the charge of the gauge bosons is fixed by gauge invariance.
You just said Dirac fermions, but haven't we been dealing with scalar mass bosons?
No, but I mean, if you couple your gauge bosons, which are indeed at that stage massless, a charged sort of photons. If you couple them to some Dirac fermions by introducing a term like that, you know, the charge of the fermions is fixed by the fact that we have a D-slash. So the charge of the fermions in proper unit is the same than the charge of the bosons. It's fixed by the gauge invariant. So it's fixed by the symmetry group here SU2, And in fact, it's fixed only by something which is and the representation in which the matter fits lives. You see, so here we took a matter field which belongs to the fundamental representation, and then the charge, the strength of the interaction with the gauge bosons is entirely fixed. Once you know the strength of the interaction between the gauge bosons themselves, you know the strength of the interaction between the matter fields and the gauge bosons.
So you just went back to the Dirac field, but is what you're saying relevant to the scalar bosons we've been dealing with most recently?
With the scalar boson?
Yes.
Yes, it's also true here, exactly for the same reason. Yes. Yes. Whatever matter field is. So you cannot play with the different charges like you are doing in quantum electrodynamics. Yes?
Sorry, maybe it goes a little bit too fast. So how do you tell the charge of the boson? So
the charge of which boson? Of this one?
This
one. Well, the charge is determined by the strength of the coupling between the gauge field and the bosonic field. You see, the only way to measure a charge is to make it interact with an electromagnetic field. If you have just an electron which doesn't interact with the electromagnetic field, it's a meaningful question to ask what is its charge, because you cannot measure it. It may very well have a charge, but you cannot measure it, so it's not a physical quantity.
I see. So actually here, the G is equivalent to the E.
Yes, yes. Because basically, a charge measures the strength of the interaction between the electromagnetic field or the gauge field and the matter field given by this vertex. And so this is very important because this explains why all the charge of the particle in the standard model are related. You know, so you know that the charge of the electron is minus one, but you know that the charge of the proton is plus one, the charge of the neutron is zero. There are no particles of charge 1.5 or 1.333 of pi or square root of 2. We know that, basically the fermions, the leptons, have charge integer or zero for the neutrinos. We know that the baryons have charge plus or minus one or zero, but that's because, in fact, they are composed of quarks, which have charges which are multiples of one third. So some quarks have charge minus one third, some quarks have charge plus two third. I don't remember the zoology of quarks. I don't remember. But there is, you see, it's multiples of one third. But there is a fixed ratio between the charge of the leptons, the electrons, the neutrino, and the charge of the quarks. And why is it so? It's because, in fact, they all belong to the same theory, which is based by a non-abelian symmetry group and the gauge invariance. So the group of symmetry is not SU2, but it's a U1 cross SU2. It's SU2 cross SU2 cross SU3 group, so it's a more complicated group, but it's a non-abelian group. So this is explained by non-abelian symmetry. You see, you cannot construct a theory of fundamental interaction where the quarks have charge one third and the electron has charge square root of pi. It's not possible precisely because of the symmetry constraint. So this was the explanation. This is the real explanation of why all the charge of a particle in the universe are related. They are multiple of each other, or in or rational ratio. Okay. So well, it's time to end up, and tomorrow I start to explain how to quantize such a theory, because this is a classical action, so we have been able to build the classical action of the theory out of first principle and gauge invariance, but now it remains to quantize the theory, of course, and that's, you'll see where functional integration becomes very, very, very useful. Because it's much, much more difficult to quantize the non-abelian theory using covariant quantization than using functional integral and path integral methods. You will see the beauty of this convention tomorrow. Yes?
So can I just clarify that G, we measure G from experiment based on E?
Yes.
Right? So the numbers determined for quarks is based because of experiment.
That's a bit more complicated, because in fact, first, you can observe. You can never observe quarks because they are confined, but that's another story. But in addition, when you are measuring a process like that, you have to take into account the fact that you have a lot of diagrams, complicated. Okay, so the charge gets renormalized. So the strength of the interaction becomes renormalized. But since all the charges are fixed, it's better to think about the charges are just unity or integer member, and to think about the strength of the interaction. So better think about G as the coupling constant. And the charges as fixed. Because they are fixed by the structure of the group. So they are rigid. So what's important is to know that some field has a charge which is two times some other fields or something like that. Okay. So it's better to think about G as a coupling constant. And you see that in this theory, the gauge theory has just one coupling constant, G. And when you couple it to Dirac fermions, you have only two parameters. You have the mass of the fermions and the coupling constant of the gauge field. And if you couple your gauge field to a scalar bosons, you have only three coupling constants. You have the coupling constant of the gauge field. You have the mass of the scalar boson. And you have the coupling constant H, which measures the strength of the self-interaction of the scalar bosons. You see? So when you couple a scalar boson to a gauge field, you have a unique way to do that. You have no choice. You cannot choose the strength of the interaction between the scalar boson and the gauge field. The strength of the interaction between the scalar boson and the gauge field is fixed by the strength of the interaction between the gauge bosons themselves, and by the fact that the scalar boson is a two-component field, therefore it belongs to the fundamental representation of the gauge group. So when you couple matter to a non-abelian gauge field, the interaction is entirely fixed by already the properties of the gauge theory and the property of the theory for the scalar field if it was not interacting. You have no freedom to play with the strength of the interaction between those two particles. You see? OK? That's the idea. Yes?
How
do you get the charge of the electrons and quarks from the first factor? This is a long story. So I say wait for the course on the standard model of electroweak and strong interaction. This will be explained in detail.